welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org again. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on cross-examination when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? Well, you know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about lawyers. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. It's worse than that. Most of the students do graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom and without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax." Now, that was Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now you know why lawyers have to hire a lawyer to represent them. They're incompetent. No plumber or carpenter is that incompetent that he can't fix his own pipes or steps, but lawyers are so incompetent they can't represent themselves. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is a school available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to your website. Go to my website, I guess I should say. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Cross-examination, one of the neatest, cleverest methodologies ever designed, either by the mind of God or the mind of man, to elicit the truth from a lying witness. I've often told my students that it isn't the worst thing that can happen to you that your opponent lies about you. In reality, that's the best thing that can happen. That's right. The best thing that can happen to you when you're in a controversy, especially in litigation, is that your opponent is lying about you. The worst thing that can happen to you is that your opponent tells the truth about you. If you lie about me, I can uncover your lies in front of everybody through the process of cross-examination. But if you tell the truth about me, I have no defense. Now, most people have it exactly backwards. They actually believe that if somebody lies about them, how can I overcome this? Especially if the police are lying about you, or your ex-husband or ex-wife is lying to the judge about you, and how am I going to overcome that? Well, there are techniques. In fact, there are 23 techniques that we use in cross-examination to elicit the truth. And from my experience, I can tell you right now that the old adage that says, keep the defendant off the witness stand, is good advice. At least it's good advice 85% of the time, because 85% of the criminal defendants who come before a judge in a courtroom are in fact guilty. The police do not do a bad job when it comes to apprehending guilty defendants. And with technology and science, such as DNA, and you see this on the television with Cold Case and these various and sundry documentaries, or I should say, I guess they're kind of dramas rather than documentaries, but they're based upon real life cases that have been solved through DNA evidence and so on. And we find now that one third, not quite a third, but 30% of all of the convictions that have been attained against rape, that is, rape perpetrators, that's rapists, are false. Every time that a rapist is convicted, the victim has to sit in the courtroom, point her finger at the defendant and say, that's the guy that raped me right there. However, we find that through DNA evidence today, that 30% of all those convictions have been false, and they've probably been false for the last 100 or 200 or 500 or 5,000 years. Now, that's not to say that all women point the finger at innocent defendants and convict them of rape. After all, a rape is a traumatic experience. And most of the time, the victim cannot recognize the rapist. And so a lineup is put together, and the police are part and parcel with this hoax, you see. And this is one of my complaints about police work. But, you know, a rape victim comes into the police station, says, I've been raped, and what was his height, weight, and shape and form, and what did he look like, and how many tattoos did he have, and like as not, this isn't at night and in the dark, and you've never seen this guy before, and maybe you can identify him as a black man, or maybe he's a white man, or maybe he's a big man or a little man, but, you know, when it gets right down to it, you've been traumatized, lady, and your mental faculties aren't really up to the task of identifying who it was that raped you. So the police will go out and they'll take the description that you give them. He's a big man or a little man, or he's a white man or a black man. And then they'll go a mile around that rape scene over there, and they'll pick up all the rapists that they know about in that mile over there, and then they'll put a lineup together. See? And maybe there's 5, 6, 8 guys here in this lineup over there, and two of them are policemen. Oftentimes I'll put a couple of policemen in there. Now, maybe we've got the real rapist in this lineup, and maybe we don't. Probably not. He's not even in the same town. He's gone. He's down the road 100, 200, 500 miles from by now. And then here we've got, but now these guys are actually guilty. I mean, these guys have been rapists in the past, and so the police say, well, can you recognize any of these guys? We picked this guy up. He was just 3 blocks away from where the rape occurred. And then this guy over here, he was only 9 blocks away, and so on. And so you look at him, lady, and you say, no, I don't think I can recognize him. He was a big guy. It would have to be like that guy on the end over there, that big guy. All right, so the policeman, now he takes this lady off camera, see here, and he says, now listen, lady. Now, that guy out there on the end that you thought raped you, well, here's his rap sheet. Now, he's raped six women over the years. He's been convicted 2 or 3 times. I mean, he's really a bad guy. And we can't convict this guy unless you can give us a positive identification. I mean, you know, we're depending on you, lady. We think that's the guy that that raped you. We're about 99% sure that that's the guy that raped you over there. But here again, if you can't identify him, why, you know, we got to turn him loose. And he'll go out and he'll rape other women. And this cop, he lays this guilt trip on you. If you don't go in there and identify that guy, lady, this guy is going to go out and he's going to rape 16 more women. And that may be the truth. I'm not exaggerating here. I mean, you know, these rapists, you know, they probably go out and rape other women. And the cop, he's not whistling Dixie through a straw hat. This doesn't mean that this is the guy on the end that raped you. It just means that he's raped in the past, and we don't like him, and we got to find somebody that raped you in order to get this case off the books. And so you go back in there, and you take a look at these guys over here, and you remember what the policeman told you, and you remember all the coaching you got from the cops over here, and how it's a civic duty to get this scum off the streets. And so you point to that guy and say, it's the guy on the end over there. Now you're committed, lady. And if you renege on this identification, the policeman says to you, we'll prosecute you for turning in a false police report. How's that? So now the police have both of you. The police have you because you can't renege on your identification, and if you do, we're going to prosecute you for this false police report, and that scares the living hell out of you, lady. And then the guy on the end over here, he's been convicted in the past, and the cops say, we got an eyewitness over here, and if you confess to this rape, we will, you know, give you 5 years in the slammer, we'll let you go. But if you don't confess to the rape, then we'll put you in jail for 30 years. And they scare the hell out of that guy. And oftentimes he'll confess to something that he knows he's going to get 5 years for, as opposed to pleading not guilty to something that he didn't do and then run the risk of getting 30 years. And that's what happened out in Wenatchee, Washington. They got a bunch of people out there that were in the child care business, you know. They were babysitters, and they were running these daycare centers, and there was an allegation made that these daycare workers out there were raping and sexually molesting little children, you know. And so many of those people actually pled guilty. Rather than go to prison for 30 years, they could go to prison for 5 or 10 years. And so they actually pled guilty to crimes that they didn't commit. And this is the famous Wenatchee child molestation case. And then about 10 or 15 years later, these little kids grow up. You know, they're 5, 6, 8 years old. Well, 10 or 15 years later, you know, they're 18, 20, 25. They said, no, these people never raped us. They didn't do anything to us. It was the police and the social workers and caseworkers that intimidated us and made us testify against them and tell these stories against these people that they hadn't done. So those kinds of things, those are the wrongs that go on. And that's what I'm aiming at here, are the wrongs that go on. But I want to point out that the police are right 85% of the time. It's the 15% of the time that the police are wrong that I want to zero in on here, so that 15% doesn't go to prison for crimes that they didn't commit, you know, like the Wenatchee people out there. And I point out rape because 30% of the time these rape convictions are actually convictions of convenience, because see, there's pressure put on to the police department by mayors and city councils and elected officials and politicians and the general public and newspapers and reporters and all this. You know, how come you cops ain't out here finding all these guilty people? And you see the problem that the police run into with it, like this BKT murder up here in Wichita, Kansas. I mean, this guy was a public official. He's the local dog catcher. He goes to church. How in the hell are the police going to catch a guy that kills, you know, somebody once every 5 years, and he has no connecting link? These are just random murders of total strangers this guy doesn't even know. He's just killing people to be killing people. And, you know, at some point in time, the police will catch up to these people, but sometimes it takes 10, 20, or 30 years. So don't get mad at the cops because they aren't doing their job. The police actually, if you get right down to it, law enforcement and criminal apprehension, do a phenomenal job. Phenomenal job. In fact, it goes a little below, beyond phenomenal. They want 100% track record. And so to boost their record, they oftentimes convict people who are guilty. I mean, they're guilty. They're criminals. They're rapists. They're bad guys. But they connect crimes with these bad guys that these bad guys didn't actually do. I would kind of prefer, just as Joe Sixpack out here on the street, that the police convict the guilty people of the crimes that these guilty people actually committed. Not convict this guy of a rape because we can't find the real rapist, and this guy is a rapist, and so let's throw him back in jail because, after all, he probably didn't serve enough time anyway. Now, there's a methodology that we use in legal procedure, this is the courtroom procedure, to identify people who are actually guilty, people who are actually lying, and people who aren't guilty, and people who are not lying, people who are telling the truth. So let me share something with you here. Did you know that you're a liar? Yeah, that's right. Listening to me over the radio right now, I want to tell you that you're a liar. And that 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. 25%. I know you're sitting there saying to me, I oftentimes do this in the classroom. I'll say, how many liars do we have in here? Nobody wants to raise his hand, you know, and wave it around, you know, like a little kid in the third grade saying, call on me, teacher. I know the answer to that. Nobody raises their hand. And so I say, well, I take it by that response that none of you people in here are liars. And everybody kind of sits there looking at you like, God, I wonder where this guy's going with this. And I ask this question. I say, well, have any of you people in here ever told a lie one time in your life? I mean, a long time ago, to be sure. Maybe when you were a little kid, 8 years old, you lied about stealing a cookie out of the cookie jar. Have any of you in here ever, at any time in the past, no matter how far back it may be, have you ever lied one time in your lifetime? And with that question, everybody will admit, yes, there was a time, though it may be far, far back in the dimmest reaches of my mind. Yes, I did actually tell a lie one time. Not a bad one, mind you, just a little white lie. A good little white lie. Okay, now we've established that you are a past tense liar. So I pause right there and I say, well, let me ask you a question. Let's go out into the future. You know, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. Do you believe, is it possible, could it be, that you might tell one more of those little white lies before you die? Just one. Before you die. Well, you know, just about everybody will admit that, I probably will lie one more time before I die. I've only told one lie a long time ago, and I probably will tell one more lie a long time out into the future. So now we've got you admitting that you're a liar in the past and that you're a future liar, more likely in the future. And then we want to put the ringer on you now and we say, let me ask you this. Have you told a lie in the recent past, like maybe this morning or maybe yesterday or day before yesterday? Did you go out to dinner and tell the cook, you know, your good friend Bob's wife over here who invited you and Mary over for dinner, and did you tell your good friend's wife what a wonderful dinner that was, but in reality you knew that it was a piece of trash? I mean, it tasted bad. Or did you tell somebody, God, you really look good, but deep in your heart you said, God, what happened to that guy? He looks like he went through a meat grinder. Have you lied recently? Well, most everybody will think about that for a second. They'll say, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I probably have lied in the recent past. And then what we have here is past, present, and future. Now we've got you down to where, yes, I've lied in the past, I will probably lie in the future, and I have lied recently. I am a liar today, I was a liar in the past, and I'm going to be a liar in the future. So now it's a little easier for me to ask the question, are you a liar? Because in the Bible, there's a statement that says, let God be true, though every man be found a liar. Every man be found a liar. So every man, at some point in his lifetime, has lied. And you're saying to yourself, what the hell's that got to do with cross-examination? It has everything to do with it. Cross-examination is for the express purpose of uncovering lies that people tell. And there are 23 methodologies that we use to uncover those lies. 23 little tricks of the trade. When I go to a deposition, and I'm asking questions in deposition, and I get the witness to tell a lie that I know. Because, see, I was at the scene of the crime. I was there. I know. And you know. You and I are at loggerheads. We're suing each other, you know, over something here in our business. And I know, and you know, but you're lying. See? And when I get a guy lying in deposition, I help him tell more lies. I encourage him to lie. I do everything in my power to get this guy to lie, to exaggerate. Especially if I can make my opponent believe that I really don't know the answer to this lie, and then he embellishes the lie, and he gets us down. Because see, there's a stenographer there, and this stenographer is taking down every word. And all of these lies that you're telling are going down on paper. And you raised your hand and you swore an oath that you were going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Remember when you sat down here? I'm going to remind you of that when we're in trial, as I point to the deposition and the questions and answers that you gave last year or 6 months ago, as I ask these questions again today. And I'm going to wrap you up in a little ball. And I'm going to expose those lies to the judge and the jury over here. And I'm going to destroy your credibility. And I got 23 techniques, 23 ways that I can do that. Now I'm going to share with you those 23 methodologies here. And I'm going to tell you where you can go get all 23 of these methodologies in one compact book. It's not a little book. It's kind of a hefty little book over here, but it's called The Art of Cross-Examination. So get your pencil out, boys and girls. Sharpen it on both ends now. And write down The Art of Cross-Examination. And you can get a copy of this. It's so popular. This book is so popular, it's actually put out now in soft cover paperback. And I think you can get one for 10 or 15 bucks. Now, If you want to go to West Publishing Company or go to your Barnes and Noble store, it's in print in hardcover. I bought one from a legal publishing house. Cost me $46, 46 bucks. But you can get one for about 10 or 12, softback. And the author is, his name is Francis Wellman, and the book was written in 1902. It's an old book, 1902. People were lying 100 years ago. Did you know that? And there were lawyers 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, who would come into court and they would expose those liars, which is the express purpose for cross-examination. It's to expose liars. Now remember I said 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. Well, falsehoods come in two forms. In law, we divide things up kind of analytically. And so we call a falsehood a fraud. So a fraud is a lie. So if I'm going to lie, that lie comes in two forms. And here are the two forms. Write this down, boys and girls. Write this down. Lying comes in two forms. When you lie because you know it's a lie, and you're telling this lie because you want to deceive me. You want me to believe something that isn't true. So you lie to me about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. See? Now, that's what we call an actual fraud, an actual lie. You lie to me. You know you're lying to me. And you're lying to me because you have an ulterior motive. That's an actual fraud. Then we have a thing called a constructive fraud. A constructive fraud is you lie to me, but you believe it's true. And I think that's where Colin Powell was. When Colin Powell was testifying before the United Nations, and he was presenting evidence to the United Nations, and he said, Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, and here's our satellite photographs, and here's this, and here's that, and here's another thing. Well, as a trained cross-examiner, and he may have been lying. I mean, he may have known that that was false, and he was telling that lie, but I think he was telling the truth. I think that Colin Powell came to the United Nations, and he, honest to God, believed what he was telling them was the truth. And in his mind, he was telling the truth. Although we have found out over several years now that these weapons of mass destruction did not exist. They weren't there. We haven't found them yet. And we've been looking mightily and diligently, which leads me to the conclusion that not only is the Bush administration corrupt, they're inept. I mean, they're just plain dumb. Because it would seem like to me that any political organization that's worth its salt would have taken weapons of mass destruction, like chemical and biological weapons, right here from the United States, loaded them on a C-5A, and flown them over there, and then stashed them around, and then come in about a month later and said, look what we found over here, weapons of mass destruction. But they didn't do that. I guess maybe they actually, honest to God, believed that there were weapons of mass destruction there. It's the best defense that the Bush administration has, that they didn't lie to us, that they, honest to God, believed that they were there, and that's why they didn't bring in the evidence and phony it up. Police oftentimes do that. They'll take drugs and plant them in your car so that they've got evidence against you of drug dealing. Now, I say often, it's a common practice. Police have throwdown weapons, and a policeman, when he goes on the job, you know, he's going to be out here for 8 hours. He doesn't know what's going to happen to him. In that 8-hour period, he gets shot at, spit on. He gets railed against and called names and one thing and another. I would never make a cop. I thought about the first day on the job and somebody called me a dirty pig, you know, he'd be picking himself up off the ground after I clubbed him over the head 4 times. I'd probably kill the guy with my billy club. I'm just not designed to be a policeman. I couldn't handle that. You know, these mob riots, you know, that these police are out there, you know, in their riot gear, and these people are throwing rocks and bottles at them. I wouldn't put up with that. And, you know, every once in a while, a cop, you know, he gets a belly full of that. He's been living like this shift after shift. You know, this is 40 hours a week that he's going through this. And one day he kind of comes unhinged, you know. And so he kills somebody. And then he looks at this dead body down here and he says, oh, my God, what have I done? I've killed this guy. Well, you know, guy's dead. Okay, now I'm gonna suffer some consequences here. And so the policeman, he takes this 25 automatic out of his pocket, and he fires off a couple of shots, and he throws it down on the ground. After he sticks it in this guy's hand, gets his fingerprints on it. You know, he takes some fingerprints off this, so that the victim that's laying on the ground's got his fingerprints on this throwdown, and then. Calls in and he says, hey, listen, I had to kill this guy in self-defense over here. Sorry as hell this happened, but, you know, he just wouldn't stop. He just kept coming at me and he's shooting at me, so I killed him in self-defense. And then we have a little inquest and we go through it. Pretty soon we exonerate the cop and we say, well, it's part of the job. And how many times does that happen? Well, I don't say every policeman in America has done that 5 times, you know, in his career. I'm just saying that it happens quite often, and we've uncovered quite a few of those, and so now we know what that modus operandi is all about. And so what we're looking for is, what do you do when you have a lying cop like that who has killed somebody and you want to uncover that? It's called cross-examination. You take the policeman's story and you run that story through and you pick out the fallacies, because that policeman, when he tells the story, if it's false, it's going to have contradictions in it. It's going to hit one of these 23 triggers over here. and we're going to identify that. But prosecutors don't do that. See, prosecutors are not in the business of convicting policemen of the crimes that they commit. The police and prosecutors work hand in glove. Prosecutors cover up police abuse. Prosecutors cover up, and judges a lot of times will do that too. I mean, you got a heavy burden to prove that this policeman violated your rights. I mean, it goes on all the time. Policemen violate people's rights every day, and that's a crime, and they ought to be punished for that crime. But judges, you know, they're not very, very inclined to go after a cop for violating your rights. Now, if you can prove that this policeman violated the law, that he knew that it was the law, and you've got him four ways to Sunday, I mean, you can win a civil rights case. But the burden of proof is on you. And you can rest assured that the police are going to come in and they're going to testify, and five policemen are going to come in and they're going to lie for this cop. I'm going to tell you a story as we progress along about lying cops and how to uncover those lies. It's not a hard job to do. And any prosecutor worth his salt could uncover the lying chicanery of the police if he wanted to, and so could the judges. They don't want to, and they don't do it. So if you want justice out of the justice system because of a lying policeman or a lying public official that is being protected by other lying public officials over here, you're going to have to do it yourself. So we're going to take our break here, and we'll be back here in about 60 seconds, and we'll take a look here at the 23 techniques to destroy your opponent in cross-examination when we come back. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches eight schools, eight subject matters in law, such as family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Remember to order yours. Just call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Remember, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, just go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, let's take a look at some of these techniques. Let's take a look at humor. Humor is a technique that we use to uncover lying. But you know, cross-examination is a two-edged sword. A witness who is skilled in examination and cross-examination can turn the tables on a lawyer, whether he's a prosecutor or a private attorney, and make that lawyer look like a fool in front of the jury. So you've got to watch out for a good witness. And so, you know, once you're trained in cross-examination, you'll also be trained as a witness. Listen to this story. A witness turns the tables on a lawyer by using humor. A fire insurance company was being sued by a merchant for the loss of its stock of caviar. The merchant, the principal witness in his own behalf, was attempting to enhance the value and the quality of his merchandise, well, at least as much as possible, without too close an approach to downright perjury. So the merchant gave testimony to the effect that practically all of the caviar in the burned warehouse was Russian beluga caviar, a most excellent and expensive brand of sturgeon caviar. Now, the cross-examiner thought that he saw an opportunity to exhibit to the jury the ignorance of the witness as well as his perjury. So he asked this question. He said, "Is it not a fact that all of your caviar in that warehouse was what is known as whitefish caviar, a poor and inferior type, not even a true caviar?" Answer, "No, sir, none of it." Question, "How do you know it was not? Do you even know where whitefish caviar comes from?" Answer, "Sure I know." Question, triumphantly, as if he were about to shatter the witness in the eyes of the jury on account of his general ignorance and his lack of knowledge of his own trade. "Where does it come from, then?" the lawyer asked. Answer, with a slight leer, "Why, from whitefish, of course." Now, there's an example of humor. There's an example of the witness making a fool of the cross-examiner. It works both ways, of course. One time my wife was in court, and she was being sued by an attorney. And the attorney's name was Jack Lyons. And Jack Lyons was representing his daughter, Dana Lyons. And Dana Lyons was married to another lawyer in the law firm, and it was Joe Lamb. So Dana Lyons was married to Joe Lamb, and Joe Lamb and Dana Lyons were suing my wife using Dana Lyons' father to represent the law firm, and they came into the courtroom, and Tony Jack Lyons was his name, told the judge that my wife was a deadbeat and she hadn't paid her bill and that she owed so much money and blah blah blah. And so the judge in this case happened to be a black judge, and my wife stood up, and when it was her turn, you know, she opened by saying, "Judge, how long will you throw me into this den of lions?" Well, now, this judge, you know, when he heard that "den of lions," you can draw the analogy here with Daniel in the lion's den, and here's Lamb and Lyons, and here's Tony Jack representing his daughter. And there was this Lyons family over here. And the judge burst out laughing. It struck him funny, and my wife went on to win the case. She should have won the case. Whether or not she told a funny or she lightened the atmosphere in the courtroom with a little joke, but I want to point out that judges, you know, are people just like we are. Jurors who are sitting over here in the jury box are people that are struck by a funny Polish joke or a funny dirty joke. You know, I mean, people are people. We all like a good joke, whether it's a dirty joke or whether it's a racist joke or whatever it is. We all listen to that. And it should be a joke in good taste, and it should be something that's relevant to the case. And if you get up there and you say, "Well, I want to tell you this story," you're going to get shot down. So it obviously has to be something that fits in with the questions and the answers. And my wife just happened to think of Daniel in the lion's den, and here are these lions over here. And she says, "You know, how long are you going to throw me into this den of lions?" And then she went on with her presentation, and she showed she didn't owe the money, and here's why, and here's the statutes, and here's the law. And the judge applied it. But the point I'm making is that humor goes a long ways in the courtroom. It's a technique that we use. Lighten up, partner. People go into court and they're all dead serious, you know, and they're just scared out of their wits. The courtroom is staffed by human beings just like we are. The court reporter, the prosecuting attorney, the judge, the lawyers, the jury, the people that are here watching, they're all people. And if they weren't in the courtroom, they would be out on the street. And if they were out on the street, they'd be doing the same things that they do every day. Court's kind of like going to church, you know. Church isn't the place where you act up and tell funny stories. It's a serious place. Court's a pretty serious place. Don't be afraid to drop a little humor. Let me give you another example here. In another recent case, an Italian contractor was suing to recover for building a masonry wall for a garage, which he alleged was in all respects built in good workmanlike manner. Now, the claim of the defense was that the wall was poorly built and not in accord with proper masonry standards. In support of this defense, the cross-examiner was trying to show that the plaintiff's employees, Italian masons, were an inferior grade of workmen and knew very little about the jobs that were required of them. So the first question was, well, was Domenico a good mason? Answer, oh yes, very fine a mason. And two, question, and Giuseppe, was he a good mason? Answer, even better. Third question, how about Giovanni? Answer, best of the three. Question, slurringly, the attorney said, well, and I suppose that you claim that all masons are good masons. Answer, no, no, just alike a lawyer's, some are good, some are rotten. Now, again, here is an example of cross-examination turning against the cross-examiner. Here is a good witness. He's a masonry contractor. Just a Joe Sixpack that's out here on the street living his life. And he puts up a masonry wall and the guy doesn't want to pay him. So he sues to get paid. And so he comes and says, well, you know, the reason I didn't pay this guy is because he didn't build that wall very well. And this mason comes in and says, well, it was a normal, everyday, garden variety job, and I did the job. Notice the racism that's involved here. These Italian masons over here can't be any good. More than likely, this took place around 100 years ago, probably around the turn of the century. And so here are these Italian immigrants, and the company that had hired him didn't pay them. So the Italian, instead of getting screwed out of his money, takes him to court. And he comes into court trying to get paid. And he's got some pretty good street sense. And when this lawyer over here is trying to make fun of and belittle these Italians, you know, I'll use the name here, you know, hey, was Domenico a good mason? Hey, what about Giuseppe? What about Giovanni over here? All three of them, you know, Italian immigrants. And they're making fun of them. They don't want to pay them. And so the immigrant, the contractor, turns the tables. Oh, by the way, he won his case. So there's a couple of examples of humor. Humor, as I said, goes a long way in helping a judge or a jury get a feel for you and who you are and what you are, that you're the normal run-of-the-mill guy over here. I wouldn't tell a dirty joke. I don't think I'd want to tell some joke that was racist or something like that. But let's be thinking about what do you come into court today. You came in here to tell them that you're a human being, that you've been wronged, you've been damaged over here, or somebody's taken advantage of you, and humor goes a long way. Now remember, I've said many a time, keep your mouth shut. Keep your mouth shut. Let me illustrate that for you here as it relates to examination and cross-examination. I told a story here not too long ago on the air about a lady by the name of Vera Stetz. And Vera was a German lady, and she had met a German doctor. They lived in New York, and she was his mistress for many years. And without getting into the details of the Stetz case, the bottom line was that they broke up, and they had some kind of an altercation. And Vera shot this German doctor and killed him with his gun in his apartment. Now, just picture this, ladies. You're a woman, and you're standing here, and you've just killed your lover. You're standing here with his gun in your hand, and there's his body bleeding on his carpet in the bedroom. And you're probably pretty shocked, and you're probably pretty traumatized. And Vera's standing there, and she says, well, it's pretty hard to deny that the guy's dead, pretty hard to deny that he's been shot, pretty hard to deny that I'm the one that shot him. So she went over to the telephone, and she called the police. Pretty logical thing for Vera to do. She called the police, and the police got there. Policeman walks into this guy's apartment, and Vera's there, and she hands the policeman the gun. She takes him into the bedroom, and she shows him the body. And she says, I shot him. Pretty open and shut case. And the policeman said, well, why did you shoot him, and how did it happen? And Vera shut up. She wouldn't tell him jack squat. She wouldn't tell him anything about the doctor. She shut up at that point, never said another word. So they arrested her, and they charged her with murder, and she bailed out, and she prepared her defense. And when they went into trial, the police did not have any evidence against Vera out of her own mouth. They had the gun. They had the body. And they said she killed him. And they painted her as the ice lady. They said that she was a cold-blooded, dirty murderer. And the newspapers were carrying these stories and blah, blah, blah. And so Vera got on the witness stand in her own defense. And here's what she said. She said, I went up to the doctor's room. And he was a German national. And he was a Nazi. And I told him that if he didn't marry me, that I was going to break it off. And he said, well, you're not going to break it off. And he threw me on the bed. And he said, I'll show you what a German does to a woman. And he was going to rape me. He ripped my clothes off, and he was in the process of raping me. And I knew that he had a gun in his drawer next to the bed. And I fought him off, and I told him no, and I said, get away from me and leave me alone. And I took the gun, and I shot him in self-defense. This was the first word that the prosecution had, that it was self-defense. And they cross-examined her, and she stuck with her story. Self-defense, 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 self-defense. And you know, there's women sitting on that jury. And they came back and they said, Vera Stetz is not guilty of murder. She had every right to kill that SOB because he was trying to rape her. Now, you want to remember that the doctor's dead. There wasn't any testimony from anybody at any time in that trial that doctor did not try to rape her. There was a lot of testimony by policemen that they found a body. There was a lot of testimony by police and forensics experts that he was shot and shot with that gun. And they had her confession. I shot him. I killed him. Here's the gun. There's the body. Now, I don't know, you know, if she she killed him with malice or what. We'll never know, will we? But there's an example of keep your mouth shut. Now, the reason that you keep your mouth shut is that 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. And here's what happens. When people have been through a trauma, like Vera Stetz, or when you kill somebody, whether you're a soldier on the battlefield and you kill somebody, you're going to remember that for the rest of your life. And soldiers that come back from the battlefield, you know, they go through all kinds of mental anguish. You don't just go out and kill people and then come back home as if nothing happened. You know, we see that in the movies. We see that in cartoons. But out here in real life, that isn't the way your mind works. That isn't the way the real world works. And coupled with the fact that 25% of what you say to people isn't true. You may believe it's true, but it's not true. It's false. Didn't occur that way at all. You've probably had that experience. You know, you're listening to a story. You were there. And a guy is telling a story. And you were there at the time. I can remember, you know, you go to your class reunion. Just try it. No, next time you're at a class reunion, and you and four or five other guys had an experience, and you did something, you know, when you were 16, 18 years old, when you were a high school kid, and you were out doing something. And so you're sitting there listening to David, who's telling this story among this group of old school mates, and he's telling this story. And you're sitting there listening. Now, you were there with David and with Ed and with Mike when this event transpired. You were a part of this event that transpired, and David is telling the story. And as David tells the story, there are certain details of the story that you know aren't true. He's embellishing the story. The fish was a big fish, but it wasn't 2 feet long. It was about 18 inches. An 18-inch fish is a big fish, but it's not 2 feet. And especially when people are talking about how fast you were driving, I'm always struck by the fact that whenever there's a story about speeding and driving, they're always driving at 80, 90, or 100, or 110 miles an hour. Boys and girls, in 1947, a car that would go 100 miles an hour was a unique machine. First time I ever went 100 miles an hour was in a 1957 Chevrolet, a brand new one, my dad's. We never had cars that go 100 miles an hour. And yet I've listened to people tell stories about how we were driving down the road and it was, 100 miles an hour. Well, I got to take that back. First time I went 100 miles an hour was in a 55 Ford with John Friesen. I was sitting in the back seat and we were testing the car, see how fast it would go. He got it up to 105, hit a little hill, you know, hit a little rise of two-lane road, you know. Why, that car went airborne when it got up on top of that little hill, that little rise, you know, in the road. Of course, we'd never been traveling at 100 miles an hour before, so the car was full of kids. I think there was six or seven of us in the car. That car came down and went sideways down the highway, about, I don't know how many feet, but ended up over in the ditch. We all survived it, but I'm just pointing out that, you know, when people tell stories, they exaggerate. That isn't the way it actually happened. And I imagine if the seven guys that were in that car that night that John Friesen took that 55 Ford up to 105 miles an hour, I imagine you get seven different stories. I just told you my version of the story. Imagine, you know, the other guys, they'd all tell a story. Well, there is one central truth that occurred in the event. It did occur, and the car, but I'll bet you somebody said, oh, hell, he hit 125 miles an hour. No, he didn't. It was 105. It said 120 on the speedometer, but a 55 Ford wouldn't go 120. It said 120 on the speedometer. We tried. It wouldn't do it. I'm just telling you, it wouldn't do it. It did make 105. Now, here's the moral to the story. When you tell that story to the police, or you tell that story to anybody, it's going to have inconsistencies in it. Let me show you what happens here. You tell that story, and I'm going to ask you 100 questions concerning that story. And out of that 100 questions, 25 of them are going to be false, or they'll have inconsistent answers. Contradictory answers. I will zero in on those 25 contradictory answers, and I will select 5 of those 25, and I will cross-examine you on the witness stand in front of those 12 jurors with those 5 false answers and hang you right out to dry. Now, the police know that, and so do prosecutors and judges, but lay people don't. And what happens is, you're telling the story the way you believe that it actually happened. It was really true. And this is done in more modern times. I'll show you from Professor Swift's experiments back in 1918, that 25% of what a witness testifies to in court, what he believes is the truth, is actually false. That's 25%. And that's when you're trying to tell the truth. 1 year later, it will be down to 50%. In 1 year, it'll be down to 50%. So half of the story, 30 years ago, that occurred in that car. If I told you the story of John Friesen and the 55 Ford, and then who was in the car? Can I remember who was in the car? I told you there was six or seven of us in the car. Yeah, I can remember three, four guys in there. And then I'll guess at the other two. And if you actually had a videotape of the event, and we could actually see the characters, and this is the way we do this in modern times, we set up two cameras at 90-degree angles. And then we stage a play, and we stage an event, and we sit all of you down with notepads. I mean, you got a pen and notepad to take notes. We let you watch this for 60 minutes, we shut it off, and we sit down and we say, here's 100 questions that we're asking you, and we have you fill out these 100 questions. That takes you about another hour. This event is fresh in your mind. It just occurred. You just watched it. And out of those 100 questions, 25 answers will be false. And you know what you're going to say? When we point out to you that these answers are false, that they're not correct, you're going to say, they are. I was an eyewitness. I know what I saw. I'm going to show you that eyewitness testimony is the least reliable evidence that you can present in court. That's an eyewitness testimony is the least reliable. And yet, we accept eyewitness testimony as if it's gospel. That's why 30% of rape convictions are false. And the woman who's pointing the finger at that rapist and says, that rapist over there, that's the guy that raped me over there, one-third of the time, that's a lie. That isn't the guy that raped you. And now with DNA evidence, we're able to prove that that's not the guy. But until 1987, with the advent of DNA, we couldn't tell. And we believed those lying women who were pointing the finger at those rapists. And if you're in jail and you're in rape and you have been convicted, that's the breaks of the game. You know, 15% of the time, we get the wrong guy. And in rape cases, it's really bad. Now, that doesn't mean that O.J. Simpson didn't kill his wife, or that Blake didn't kill his wife and get away with it. What I'm pointing out is that, yes, it's true that there are criminals that commit crimes, and most criminals do not get caught the first time they commit a crime. And most of the police, when they're pulling somebody in, they're pulling a guy in that has a record. He has a history of violence, or a history of rape, a history of breaking the law. So, you know, you can't fault the police and say, listen, the policeman's over here getting the wrong guy. 85% of the time, they're getting the right guy. But there's that 15% of the time that they got the wrong guy, and if you're that wrong guy that the police have fingered, then the burden is on you to prove your innocence. And if you fail to do that, you're liable to spend 5 or 10 years in slammer. So, learning cross-examination is not a bad idea at all, is it? Especially if you could prove that the policeman is lying about you, or if you could prove that that witness over there could not, did not see you as the rapist. That's the story. So we'll take a look at some of these stories as we progress along, as this series progresses, in The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman. You can probably get a copy of it at Barnes & Noble. Remember that title again, The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman. 1902 is the copyright on it. Well, I'm about out of time. We've got to wrap this up, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Keep in mind, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. Remember, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school or the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.